ナモタサムカワトハラハトサンマサンブタサナモタサムカワトハラハトサンマサンブタサナモタサムカワトハラハトサンマサンブタサブタンタマンサンカンマサミ
So we've started our rains retreat this year with the customary practice of going to pay our respects to our seniors and to and we've also started with instruction.In the Vinaya and particularly the Kovat, the monastic form, or that which goes to constitute the monastic form. And this is comparable to the bark, to the epiderm of the tree, great tree.Of the Buddha Sasana, it can't survive if there's only the heartwood. Maybe the heartwood is the most valuable part of the tree. The heartwood being the practice of meditation and the development of samatha and vipassana and the liberation from attachment.To the five khandhas, but the heartwood practices the essence of Buddha Dhamma can only survive in the world and has only flourished in the presence of a monastic order, and the monastic order is sustained and protected with the vinaya and the kovat.We can talk about core wat practices, the various watas that we've been studying as monastic culture. We've been learning our culture. There is a worldly culture, a samsaric culture, and the monastic form is the monastic culture. So we've been learning some of the elements of that.Of our culture, the culture that we've taken on consciously rather than being born into. But now we are moving inwards, and although strictly speaking as forest monks, the meditation practices, the sitting and the walking form or should formthe heart of our life. Sometimes we can get distracted from them or get into a bit of a rut or not put as much effort into them as we might. Sometimes there are other preoccupations that can seem at least temporarily to be more important or to take precedence. Sometimes there are things that need to be done. So this monastic retreat period, this next week, is one in which we very consciously turn inwards, turn towards the development of citta bhavana. I think Ajahn Gyanadhamma went through different kinds of culture, different kinds of cultivation that the Buddha.Talked about physical culture, the development, the kaya bhavana, sila bhavana, citta bhavana, panya bhavana. These are the development and that we are devoting ourselves to. Now in this particular period, we're really trying to focus our efforts and sometimes get the feeling that It's rather like the magnifying glass. When you're a kid, you might have liked to play with a magnifying glass and gathering all the sun's rays in a particular spot. If you were a naughty boy, you used it to burn the legs off insects. If you were a more moral boy, then you burnt bits of paper. But anyway, it always seemed to me doing this is absolutely magical. How you weren't actually creating anything; you were just bringing something together which already existed. And the power and the energy of the mind are very much like this. It's usually so diffuse, and we allow the energy of the mind to run away or to dissipate through indulgence in sense experience, indulgence in conversation, indulgence in various kinds of distractions, that we can start to doubt even whether our mind has that kind of power and radiance. It seems just too alien from our everyday experience of ourselves. And being caught up with content already do have a tendency to tend to give more importance, more weight, more significance to the unwholesome dhammas in our minds. Coming to Buddhist monastic form, Buddhist monastery, in order to purify the mind, then one becomes that much more sensitive to the stains and the blemishes of the mind, just as when the laymen first come and they start wearing white clothes and they start to notice all the stains and dirt patches very much more than they would if they were wearing clothes of another color. It's not that they're getting any more dirty than they would otherwise, but it's more visible. And this happens to all of us, even when we've gone on to wearing the yellow robe. In our minds, we've become so much more sensitive to defilements, and so much more sensitive to our faults and vices and bad habits, that I think it's a common experience to feel actually we're going backwards, that there seems to me all kinds of problems and all kinds of difficulties and defilements that didn't seem to be there before we lived in this way. Of course, it's not the case, but it is. You're looking at things that living in the world, you have so much opportunity to turn your back on, or to excuse, or else, in many cases, you're just so identified with these thoughts and views and desires and passions that the idea of them as being some disturbing guest doesn't really arise. So in our monastic life, in the way that our teacher Ajahn Chah taught, our foundation is comprised of sila, to say the vinaya rules, the korvat, and right view. These are the two poles of the monastic training that Ajahn Chah established, his particular style, the two things that he stressed more than anything else, putting great effort into studying, memorizing, assimilating the vinaya rules as a way of grounding oneself in the present, as a way of being in touch with one's body, one's actions and speech, removing the causes for remorse, increasing, enhancing sense of self-respect, self-esteem, and also the straightening of our views. That's actually not so much Ajahn Chah's idiom, but the sutta idiom, the word that the Buddha used. We all have views already, but they're crooked. So we can just straighten our views, and so consciously abandoning views that lead to increased suffering and defilement, and adopting those views which lead to coolness, which lead to peace, which lead to wisdom and understanding. Without foundation of sila, without the foundation of right understanding, clear comprehension of why we're here, what the purpose of meditation is, what the goals of meditation are, then meditation can become another deluded activity and can lead us to more attachment than to a removal or a destruction of attachment. So although we talk about sila, samadhi, and banya in the threefold training, in fact, of course, wisdom, at least on one level or another, has to precede sila and samadhi. And the practice, even the practice of samatha, is not divorced from the need for wisdom. It's not that you develop high samadhi states and then turn to a development of wisdom. You already need a certain amount of wisdom to even get started. For instance, the wisdom that sees the value of meditation, the value of mental cultivation. It's not at all an obvious view to take up, and many people in the world would reject that view or find it incomprehensible. In the practice of samatha, that is to say, the stilling, the calming, brightening of the mind, there has to be the wisdom that sees the insubstantiality, the shallowness, the superficiality, the pointlessness of distractions. If we lack that, then there's always going to be this conflict in the mind. Without wisdom, then we tend to get caught in a situation where we want peace, we want to develop samadhi, but yet we are not yet ready, really, to abandon the obstacles to it. Sometimes there can be this kind of hope that somehow we can get away with it, somehow we can sort of cheat it and cheat the process, if you like, and be able to develop peaceful states of mind without abandoning our attachments. Perhaps if we just put them aside for the moment. But this practice is one of renunciation. And we lead a renunciant lifestyle on every level to accustom the idea, accustom ourselves to the idea of renunciation, to develop a taste for it, to allay our fear of it, to see that you give something up, and you're not harmed by it, you're not mortally wounded by it, nothing terrible happens, quite the opposite, you feel lighter, you feel free. It's the putting down of a burden. In the monastic training, we start to experience the truth of this, to begin with, on the physical level. We find we can give up a second, a third meal, and nothing very difficult about it at all. Something that perhaps before coming to the monastery find a bit daunting. In fact, it's not a great problem at all, sleeping on the floor. All the hardships or austere sides of life, in at least from a worldly point of view. This is a gradual training in this idea and this concept, this beautiful concept of renunciation. As we become more confident with this concept of renunciation through the physical expressions of it, then when we come to the mind and we become more willing to renounce our attachments, that the leaving the home life, what does that mean? Well, of course, on one level it means saying goodbye to family, changing our clothes, shaving head, and so on, as the external leaving the home life. But you can still carry your home around with you, carry your parents, carry family, old girlfriends around with you. It's not that walking into the monastery somehow wipes out your memory. It's still there. It's how you practice with your memory, how much importance you give it, how much you cherish your memories. This is another word for attachment, the cherishing of things. What do we hold dear? It's what you have to renounce, what you hold dear, and that's a bit frightening, isn't it? And then we have to really ask ourselves, well, do we want to do that? And often here we see why the mind is refusing to become calm is because we're still holding on to these things as anchors. We cherish them. We cherish those memories, those relationships, those thoughts, those views, that cherishing, that holding dear, is what prevents the mind from going to calm state. There has to be this willingness to put down, put behind you. This is the renunciant mind, the mind of the renunciant. Is the mind which is light enough to go beyond the gravitational pull of the earth and of the sense objects. So how is it that you're willing to do that? Where do you find that kind of energy from? And you can see that there are two main factors involved here. One is faith and one is wisdom. And this is reflected in the first level of enlightenment, the one on the path of stream entry. Buddha talked about the two kinds of personality, if you like, two kinds of person. Two kinds of meditator or monk. There's the one who's powered by faith primarily, and one who's powered by wisdom. Of course, that's not to say that the wisdom character will be devoid of faith, or that the faith character will be devoid of wisdom. But this is the prominence, that which takes precedence, that which is most clearly seen. with faith, then we take the Buddha's word for it. We take our teacher's word for it, that renouncing all that we hold dear is for our welfare and for our happiness, and indeed for the happiness and welfare of all sentient beings. And we hear the Buddha's words, and we get hairs rise on the back. We get this incredible feeling of yes, that's true. It's not wisdom; you don't see it yet. But you feel it. Yes, there's some sense of deep recognition, and you're willing to let go because of that belief and that willingness to take the risk. So something we talk about faith as being a leap. You take a leap of faith, and then that's what faith gives you. It gives a ability just to put down all your thinking and your rational mind and the pros and cons and, well, what if this happens and that happens, or maybe, and all those kinds of pettifogging doubts, and you just jump. You just jump into the great sea of Buddhism, and you float. It's like the way that, you know, throwing a kid in the deep end and they learn to swim because they have to. And if you just throw yourself into great sea of Buddha Dhamma, then the same thing happens. You find miraculously that you do float, you can swim. So in meditation, we have, if we're not peaceful, whatever the particular hindrance that may be arising, most often, whether it's sensual desires or ill will, sloth and torpor, agitation, doubt, then these are the manifestations of certain basic attachments, certain things that we're cherishing, certain things that we're holding on to that we're not yet willing to renounce. And so, apart from the basic methods of dealing with hindrances, strengthening sati, being very sharp in our minds so that we can catch the hindrance when it's just first starting to arise, or after hindrances have passed away, looking back and trying to determine particular ways that we've made it easy for the hindrance to arise, or ways that we can make it a lot more difficult for the hindrance to arise in future, or ways of protecting ourselves from it. There's that. And that's a very important part of practice. But at the same time, we need to give some time to really looking at what underlies the hindrances. You know, are there some very deep attachments there that we can recognize? Is there some basic lack of faith in the Buddha's teaching, which makes us still instinctively, emotionally prefer the warmth, the comfort that comes from certain thoughts, certain ideas, certain memories, and just sort of shacking up with them and just hanging out with them and refusing to go beyond? Wisdom faculty. Using the wisdom faculty to constantly remind oneself. This is not something that you do once or twice and then you know it and you don't have to think about it anymore. The reflections on impermanence, reflections on dukkha, reflections on anatta, even if they are on the level of sanya, memory, perception, these strengthen the mind. They are barami in the mind. They're maturing factors in the mind. And outside of meditation practice, constantly inclining the mind to the recognition of the three characteristics. These three characteristics are not something that you have to project onto your experience. I'll try to force the things that happen in your life into some kind of conceptual framework. This is the anicchang, dukkhang, anatta. These are just expressions, verbal expressions of the way things are. It's a matter of opening your eyes to anicchang, dukkhang, anatta, not trying to sort of impose this Buddhist philosophical framework on your life or your experience. Of course, the calmer your mind is, the more sati, the more mindfulness you have, the less proliferation and the less self-obsession that you have, the more easy it is to do that. But through being impressed by the three characteristics, if you're making your mind malleable with samadhi, it means that you're impressed by the nature of experience more and more. You're open to it, you're affected by the three characteristics rather than affected by the pleasant or unpleasant aspect of an object. So the coarse mind is one which is reacting blindly to the affective aspect of an object, whether it gives us pleasure or displeasure, whether we like it or we dislike it, whether it agrees with our views or not. The mind which is calm, which is reduced or eradicated five hindrances, is one which responds and is sensitive to the three characteristics of existence. And this has to be something carried on continually, and over and over and over again, without getting bored with it, waking up to, opening your eyes to, consciously recognizing these three characteristics, until you begin to see, as Ajahn Liam was saying the other day, just that from this point of view, there's nothing which has any real enduring value, nothing that is worth holding on to, making a fuss about, cherishing. And as the ability to see this, the softening of the mind, or it's the opening of the mind, is affected through concentration on an object, similarly, that insight, basic kind of insight, this is not very high level vipassana, this is quite basic, is reinforcing your ability to concentrate on the object. Because as you are mindful of the breath, or mindful of your parikamma, word, butto, or mindful of your meditation object, whatever it should be, when a distraction arises, when something appears in the mind, then that wisdom which knows instinctively that this is just more dross, it's just more of the same stuff, that sanya that you've developed through opening your eyes to experience in daily life is what allows you, gives you the strength to let go. So there are these two strands, the sata, the faith, the faith in yourself, faith in your ability to realize the truth of Buddha's teachings, faith in your capacity to realize upajara samadhi, apana samadhi, or whatever. You need that kind of faith, and faith that it's the most wonderful thing that you can do with your life. The only thing that can give your life any real meaning, and it's that which makes the one's life excellent. There's this search for excellence. What does it mean to this word excellence in relation to a human existence? What is the search for excellence? So this is an incredible honor, an opportunity to be able to practice in this way, and this sense of uplift that we should have the merit to have come this far already, as young, healthy, reasonably young, reasonably healthy people. That we are able to practice the Buddha's teachings. This is the emotive side, the heart side, the faith. And then there's the intellectual side, the side of consciously developing this sanya, that all conditioned phenomena are poisonous, like poisonous snakes. Every single experience in life is a poisonous snake. Now, I mean, that may sound a little bit negative, perhaps, except if you think that poisonous snakes are... What does it mean to say that a snake's poisonous? I mean, a snake doesn't sort of slither along thinking, I'm a poisonous snake. I mean, it's only poisonous if a human being is stupid enough to tread on it or frighten it, and then it bites you. Then you call it poisonous because it's caused you pain. I mean, the snake's just a snake. I mean, it's just it's just what it is. And if a snake was to live its whole life and never bite anybody, would it be fair to call it a poisonous snake? Or say yes, because it's got the potential to bite someone who goes too close to it or treats it in the wrong way. And this is the same way we talk about sankharas as being like poisonous snakes. I mean, they have the potential to cause us dukkha if we relate to them in the wrong way. So they're always there's this danger about them. You know, you have to be very, very careful around sankharas. There's this kind of tension there, just about living in the world of conditioned objects, because the moment you're careless, that's it. You know, they're going to bite you. So dukkha doesn't just mean that something is making you feel painful and causing you pain in the present moment, but it means that it's ready to cause you pain at any time, that you're heedless, that you are vulnerable to sankharas at any time in which you abandon the Dhamma. It's the Dhamma which protects you. It's in the Buddha's saying, Dhamma hawe rakati tamachari. Dhamma protects those who practice the Dhamma. That's your protection. Nothing else can protect you at all. So seeking to move away from the false and the deceitful kinds of refuge towards the true refuge, refuge of Buddha Dhamma Sangha, of knowing, seeing, refuge of truth, the refuge of straight practice, sincere practice to realize the truth. These are what you can take moment by moment as your refuge. Taking the truth of things, taking the awareness of truth, taking the effort to realize the truth. These are refuges that are real refuges. And something which are practical refuges in your life and won't let you down. So the practice of meditation is not something that we can ultimately separate from any other part of our life. And there is value to be had from every experience in meditation. Because it's an illuminating process. Maybe some of the things that it illuminates are not things that you'd particularly like illuminated. Perhaps you'd like them to be kept in the cupboard under the stairs, but I mean, that's just the way that light works. It shows you things, and it shows you all these habits that you've accumulated, desires, wanting it to be a certain way, constantly harking back to one morning or one afternoon 5 years ago where you had some kind of special experience that you totally startled you and which has never ever happened again. And so many people can get into this sort of the golden age kind of syndrome, you know, and wanting to get back to some golden hour of meditation years and years ago, make that the goal of their life. Whereas what's more valuable to see is just this, the tendency of mind, or this desire to recover something which is lost, and the sense of, and how you set yourself up for frustration when you can't do it. This is the essence of samsara. This is how you create this whole mess moment by moment, wanting things, something to be a certain way, and then getting upset when it isn't that way, wanting people to be a certain way, or wishing they weren't that the way they are. And this is a very mundane kinds of habits in the mind, which are illuminated through meditation, the urge for distraction, noticing what boredom does to your mind, what anticipation does to your mind. These things, I feel, are so much more valuable to go into than just wishing for some kind of special light show, or some special vision, or some special experience. We have to constantly remind ourselves that the meditation is not about the specific experience, but becoming the knower of the world, knowing the world of all experience. So it's knowing of experience rather than absorbing into a particular experience. So there are experiences on the path which are strengthening and which are important parts of this quest. But the moment you start wanting to attain something rather than wanting to let go of the obstacles towards it, that's the subtle difference, which can tip chanda into tanha. And this is another middle way. You know, this is another part of the skill, or the art, science of meditation, is constantly caring for your intention. You're walking a tightrope. And it's so easy for this whole wholesome aspiration, this will towards goodness, will towards truth, will towards freedom, which is absolutely essential in spiritual life and in this quest, how to protect that from becoming craving and tanha. You can just tip over just like that in a moment, if you're not careful, if you're heedless. So this is one skill you have to develop. Tanha desires some kind of feeling. Tanha is bound up with a sense of self. Chanda wants truth. Chanda wants freedom. Chanda wants the good. There's no I involved in that. But that I wants to get in there. It wants to be born. It wants to expand, and you have to, as best you can, protect your chanda, your kusala chanda, your dhamma chanda. And really consciously develop this kind of aspiration. This is the value of prayer, which, you know, in Theravada tradition, you don't hear prayer talked about very much at all. In Tibetan tradition, hear it a bit more, but that you can really focus energy, bring up a lot of energy through praying to Buddha Dhamma Sangha. I mean, even the word is all sounds a bit sacrilegious, you know, and rather than be in Theravada tradition, out of praying to Buddha Dhamma Sangha, we sort of raise the hackles of a few of the traditionalists. The idea is that it's a way of clarifying your intention. It's not like that you're expecting some external being, external force to bless you, so much as it's a skillful means to clarify what you're doing. May the Buddha Dhamma Sangha bless me to let go of all my attachments for the welfare and happiness of myself and all sentient beings. Developing this kind of aspiration, or we could call it prayer, surely. And this is a way of developing chanda and strengthening it and protecting it from the dark forces of craving and tanha. And the more you're clear with yourself about what you're doing, then the easier it is to remember what you're doing. And this remembering your purpose, being aware of your purpose, clear comprehension of purpose, this is what enables you to maintain meditation, mindfulness on an object. Why is it that we get distracted so often? Why is it that the mind goes off the object, into agitation, into dullness, into defilement? What is it that the mind's looking for? It's obviously not looking for truth and wisdom and freedom. So seeing the kind of the basic hypocrisy of the unenlightened mind, you know, it's not very straight. It's got a forked tongue. And so trying to heal that, bring it onto the right path. And sometimes bowing, prostrations, devotional practices, and some kind of your own individual prayers and aspirations can really help with that process. So using faith, using wisdom to take the mind beyond the world and to delight in the abandonment of the unwholesome and development of the wholesome. This is one of the qualities, the virtues of the Aryavamsa, the noble lineage. So these are a few thoughts on practice which I'd like to share with you this evening.